I'm glad to hear they're ringing the bells for Turing, but I wish they'd stop on the whole. Great to see you all here. Thank you all for coming. I hope you're enjoying yourselves. I'm going to talk about cryptography, what happened here, Turing's role. So before picking up the Bletchley Park story, let me go back a few years to the University of Cambridge. So Turing was a shy, boyish-looking genius studying mathematics at King's College, Cambridge. He was researching a very abstract problem in the foundations of mathematics. And while he was working on that problem, he managed to invent, kind of completely by accident, the fundamental logical principle of the modern computer. Nobody could possibly have guessed that anything of any practical value whatsoever would come from that abstruse research of Turing's, let alone a machine that would change all our lives. I guess everyone knows, well, if you can operate a personal computer, you know that the way to get the machine to do the job that you want, word processing, say, is to locate the appropriate program in memory and click on it. That's called the stored program concept. And essentially, that was what Turing invented in Cambridge before the war. He described a machine that he called a universal computing machine, and he showed that by changing the program in memory, this machine could be made to run any program that could possibly be written. This was all on paper. There was no engineering at this time. That came later. So Turing's fabulous idea, really, back in 1936, was for a single machine of fixed structure, a single slab of hardware, that by making use of coded instructions stored in its memory, the stored program, could change its behavior with maximum flexibility. It could change itself from a machine dedicated to one particular task into a machine dedicated to a completely different task. It could change itself from word processor to calculator to chess opponent. We know all about the single slab of hardware that can do all these different wonderful things just by changing the instructions in its memory. And that fundamental idea, as I say, goes back to Turing in 1936. And the whole history of modern computing branched away like a tree from that root in Cambridge. I guess nowadays, when practically everyone owns a physical realization of a universal Turing machine, Turing's idea of a one-stop-shop computing machine is liable to seem as obvious as, you know, the wheel and the arch and the cart and all those other things. Must have been absolutely jaw-dropping. Imagine the first time that somebody turns up at your village with a wheel. But now we just regard them as completely obvious, and, you know, how come somebody didn't think of them even before? But in 1936, when Turing thought up his idea of this maximally flexible machine, engineers thought in terms of building different machines for different purposes. If you wanted a machine for one thing, you built a machine for that. If you wanted a machine for another thing, you built a machine for that. So Turing's idea of a single universal machine was revolutionary, startling. It wasn't until Turing moved here in 1939 at the outbreak of war that he was in the right place to discover how to build his world-changing idea of a universal stored program computer. That didn't actually come till later. It wasn't until after the war that Turing rolled up his sleeves and actually got involved in computer design. But it was right here at Bletchley Park that he first learned of the technology that he needed in order to realize a universal Turing machine in hardware. And that was electronics, which he first encountered thanks to a great engineer, Tommy Flowers, who I'll tell you about further on. But in 1939, when Turing first arrived here, he had another problem on his mind, which at the time was much more pressing than the idea of building a universal computing machine, and that was Enigma. During 1940, the first full year of the war, the people here were reading German Air Force Enigma. Well, not quite by the bucketful, but in quite plentiful quantities. Turing had a role in breaking Air Force Enigma. He broke the Enigma key, the Enigma crypto net, as I guess more modern terminology would be, sort of a flavor of Enigma. He broke the flavor of Enigma that they called blue. As you probably know, they named the different Enigma keys by colors, first of all, blue, green, yellow, red, and so on. And then they moved on to other systems of nomenclature, flowers and fish and so on and so on. But anyway, blue was an Air Force key, and Turing broke it very early on. It turned out, rather disappointingly, to be just a training key. The Enigma operators used it to kind of practice, to get up to speed in sending messages. So it never carried real intelligence, but nevertheless, breaking it was a great intellectual feat, and it got them into the game early on. Reading Air Force Enigma played a huge role in the Blitz, because the German bombers were guided by beams that were sent out from continental Europe. So there'd be two beams, you know, separated by quite a large distance, and the beams intersected over the target. So the German bombers were able to listen to the beams as they flew along, and they'd be able to judge where the point of intersection was, so they knew they'd reached the target. The flaw was that the beam operators were sent the coordinates for that day or that night by Enigma. So the codebreakers here at Bletchley were able to tell what the coordinates were, so they knew what the target was, and so the RAF would be waiting for the bombers when they turned up. So let me take you back to those dark days in 1940 and 1941, when Turing and his fellow codebreakers here in Hut 8 were battling against the German U-boats. I guess the fact that it took Turing 20 months to break U-boat Enigma is an indication of the difficulty of U-boat Enigma compared to the other flavours of Enigma. The basic situation was simple. The Atlantic was the highway for all the materials that Britain needed to prosecute the war, because all those materials, petrol, munitions, food, was coming from America and Canada in gigantic merchant convoys that were bringing the stuff across the North Atlantic. And the U-boats were preying on the convoys. They were sinking huge numbers of these merchant vessels. So the materials essential to the prosecution of war were going to the bottom of the North Atlantic. The situation was so serious that in June 1941, Churchill's advisers told him that if nothing could be done about the U-boats, then within a few months, Britain would be spiralling into starvation and so would be defeated not by military action, but by sheer shortage of materials. And just in the nick of time, Turing and his colleagues broke U-boat Enigma. They started reading it in real time in June 1941, that same month that Churchill was receiving such pessimistic news from his advisers. And the effect of the intelligence that Turing was able, with his colleagues, to wring out of these U-boat messages was tremendous and immediate. Because the problem of protecting the convoys from the U-boats was actually quite simple. If only you knew the positions of the U-boats, then you could simply route the convoys round them. And in the vast Atlantic waste, there was no hope of the U-boats spotting the convoys. So once Turing was reading the daily U-boat messages, the messages were declaring the positions of the U-boats, and so the convoys could simply be routed round the U-boats. It was very simple, very effective, and so effective was the intelligence that Turing was producing that for the first 23 days of the month of June, not a single convoy was sighted by a U-boat. It's an astonishing statistic, I think, because in the preceding weeks and months, the U-boats had been sinking thousands and thousands of tons of shipping, and then for 23 days, not a single sighting of a convoy. Turing was greatly assisted in breaking U-boat Enigma and naval Enigma generally by the Royal Navy, because the Navy were able to board German vessels from time to time and come away with Enigma materials, code books, all sorts of juicy stuff that would then be rushed back to Bletchley Park for analysis. This is the U-110, and it has just been blasted to the surface by a depth charge. The U-110 was trying to attack a convoy. It had just sunk a couple of merchant vessels. The Royal Naval Corvette, or Brescia, was able to get a fix on the U-110 and drop 10 depth charges directly overhead. And as a result of this depth charge attack, the U-110 erupted to the surface. Lieutenant David Balm, who led the boarding party onto the U-110, he said that seeing a U-boat blasted to the surface by a depth charge attack was the dream of every U-boat attack officer. Because normally in a successful attack, of course, the U-boat just sank without a trace. So to see the U-boat hurtle to the surface was a wonderful thing. As soon as the U-boat reached the surface, the German sailors started throwing themselves into the Atlantic because they believed, of course, that the U-boat in its very fragile state would sink any second. So they were leaping into the sea, thinking that was a much safer option than staying on board the U-boat. And according to the official British naval report, the German sailors were hastened on their way by small arms fire. They were hauled aboard the Aubrecia. The Aubrecia rescued all the German sailors.
Barm went aboard with his team of men, and they found an Enigma machine plugged in, looking as though it was in the middle of sending a message when the depth charge attack happened. The captain of the U-110, Julius Lemp, would have been under the strictest of instructions to destroy, throw into the water, the Enigma machine and all Enigma materials if there was any danger at all of his vessel being boarded. But he didn't. He just left it all there. He must have been absolutely certain that the U-110 was going to sink a split second later. But it didn't. It remained floating for 3 or 4 days before it finally sank. And so Barm was able to go on board, carry off an Enigma machine and various other bits of priceless material. There were code books, and also there were non-Enigma related materials such as German charts of German minefields and other useful stuff. Turing was greatly assisted in his attack on naval Enigma and the other flavours of Enigma by his bomb, which he did the logical design of the bomb in the final months of 1939. It must have been an incredibly busy and incredibly exciting time for Turing. He was working on naval Enigma, he was working on Air Force Enigma, he was designing the bomb. The bomb is, of course, named after the Polish bomber, which was a much smaller, much simpler device that the Polish codebreakers had built before Britain declared war on Germany. Why they called it the bomber, nobody quite knows. Maybe it's after the Polish name for an ice cream bomb in French, you know, an ice cream bomb. But no one quite knows. But anyway, the British bomb was named after the Polish bomber. The great codebreaker, Dilly Knox, like Turing, was a genius and a great eccentric and one of the best codebreakers that the world has ever seen. Dilly Knox went to Poland just before the war, and he saw the Polish bomby in the underground room where they were slogging away against Enigma. And he came back to Britain and he said to Turing, well, you know, I've just seen these very interesting machines that the Poles have got, but I don't think much of their design because their design focuses on a very specific feature of the Enigma traffic. And that feature could vanish at any moment. And if that feature does vanish, then the Polish machines will be completely useless. So Turing designed a much more flexible kind of bomb. In fact, that feature of the traffic that the Polish bomby did exploit did vanish in May 1940. But because Turing's bomb was so much more flexible, it was able just to cruise on. The fact that that particular feature had disappeared made no difference to the bomb. The prototype of Turing's bomb was installed in the spring of 1940. They called it simply the Victory. To give you some idea of the scale of the machine, 7 feet tall, each of the drums or cylinders simulated one of the wheels in the Enigma machine. So there were 3 wheels or 4 in the naval case. And each of these cylinders kind of mimicked a wheel of the Enigma machine. So when you turned the bomb on, these drums would all rotate very rapidly and the bomb would search for a way of breaking into the particular message that they were attacking. And then the bomb would suddenly stop. And when it stopped, all eyes were on these 3 drums here. And when the bomb stopped, these drums would contain the bomb's best guess at the positions of those 3 wheels in the Enigma machine at the start of enciphering the message. Because the German operator, before they started on each new message, they'd twist those 3 wheels to a new position, the message start position, it was called. And so if you wanted to break the message, then you needed to find out what the message start position was. Where were the wheels at the commencement of the encryption process? And so when the bomb stopped, that's what, if you were lucky, would show up on these 3 drums, the start positions of the Enigma's 3 wheels. And so as soon as the bomb stopped, they'd copy down those start positions, take them into another room where someone was sitting with an actual Enigma machine, and they'd twist the wheels to the positions that the bomb had found, and they'd start trying to decipher the German message. And if German came out, all was well. They'd found the settings, they'd cracked the message. If gobbledygook came out, then they hadn't found the right settings. The bomb had given the wrong answer. So then they just pressed the start button again and searched some more. The bomb didn't just search exhaustively, though. You've probably all heard about exhaustive search in chess programming. One way to write a chess-playing computer program would be just to program the machine to search through all the possible moves that are available to it, and then to score the moves in accordance with some ranking system that the programmer has supplied. So the machine just then searches through the whole space of chess moves that are available to it, and then it picks the best move and makes it, and then the process goes on and on. You could write quite a simple chess playing program in that way. The only snag is that it would take millions and millions of years for the computer to play the game right out by using that kind of chess playing algorithm. And that's because there are just such a huge number of possible chess moves. So the number of moves that it's searching through is so vast that it would take it, you know, probably longer than the number of, you know, seconds remaining in the future of the universe to actually play out the game. It was the same with the bomb. There were so many Enigma settings, the positions of the wheels and also the positions of plugs in the plug board and various other bells and whistles that the operator set before enciphering the message. There were just so many possible settings of the Enigma machine that if you tried to search through them all, you'd be there forever. You'd never get real-time intelligence out of your messages. So the bomb did not use exhaustive search. That would have been totally pointless. Turing found a way of narrowing in the focus onto a particular region of the possible search space. And that's also a technique that he was pretty soon advocating for use in chess-playing programs, and which has been generalized in all sorts of ways. It's called heuristic search nowadays. That's not what Turing called it. And Turing thought of it here in, at Bletchley Park. And as far as I know, the bomb is the first machine that implemented the concept of heuristic search, as we call it now. Let me give you an example to make the idea of heuristic search kind of more graspable if you're not into computer science yourself. The idea that Turing used was to speed up the bomb search by incorporating shortcuts in the process. And as we all know, shortcuts are great. They can get you to your destination much faster than, you know, going the ordinary route. But the trouble with shortcuts is that sometimes they go wrong. Sometimes the road's blocked or you just arrive in the wrong place. Shortcuts are great things, but sometimes they fail. And that's the peril of using shortcuts. A kind of shortcut that everyone would be familiar with, I guess, and this is an example of what computer scientists would call a heuristic. Suppose you've lost your keys, you've dropped your keys somewhere. Your keys could be anywhere in the city. Come to that, they could be anywhere in the universe. So if you search for them exhaustively, there's going to be an awful lot of places that you've got to look at. So we all use a shortcut. You start looking in the vicinity of the place where you think you dropped your keys. And that's a good shortcut. It will often work. It won't always work, because if you dropped your keys just as you were getting off a bus, then they could be, you know, 20 miles away from the place where you dropped them by the time you start looking. But that's how heuristics are. That's how these shortcuts are. They work often enough to be useful, but they're not guaranteed to work. And that's how it was with the bomb. It used these shortcuts that were successful often enough for the bomb to be of priceless value, but the shortcuts didn't always work. So sometimes when the bomb stopped, it would have the wrong answer on the indicator drums. And that's just because of that general feature of heuristics or computational shortcuts. They sometimes produce the wrong answer. So Turing, as a result of seeing the success of heuristic search in the bomb, glimpsed this vision of the future in which it would be possible to mechanize human intelligence, to use computers or other machines in order to carry out the sort of work that requires intelligence when human beings do it. Because, of course, that's what the bomb was doing. Breaking the Enigma messages required great intelligence when human code breakers did it. And Turing had built this dumb machine to do tasks that would require intelligence if human code breakers were doing them. So here was this wonderful idea, machine intelligence or artificial intelligence, as we call it, the idea of using heuristics and other methods in order to program computers to behave intelligently, perhaps even to think. On my way of telling the story, Turing's bomb is the first milestone on the road to modern artificial intelligence. Turing was hooked immediately, as soon as he saw the potential with the bomb. And in his spare time, he started trying to further this idea of mechanizing human intelligence. And he moved first from code breaking to chess, and then he moved on to other areas. That was Turing's idea of leisure. After a hard week code breaking, he'd sit in the pub with Donald Mickey or Jack Good or some other of his colleagues, and he'd talk about the mechanization of human thought processes. That was Turing's idea of relaxation.